above a large neodymium magnet. And when I saw the movement, it was very weird because I've seen Meissner effect before. And there's a subtle kinetics to Meissner effect. If you pull up a YouTube, you'll see it's kind of stop and go, whereas with dielectric material, it just kind of slides and gets somewhat repelled.
In other words, what they're claiming is room temperature superconductor, if I understand correctly, is not quite a superconductor. Would be nice. I'd like to have a superconducting antenna, wouldn't you?
Well, I don't know if it would really add that much if you think about it, because, I mean, what's the insertion loss of say, a standard, even an aluminum? You know, resistance isn't probably, unless you're dealing with something like magnetic loops, isn't much of a thing. If resistance was really important for antennas, then probably they would be all made out of copper, which is much better conductor than the aluminum that a lot of antennas are built for. So I don't think you'd get that much bang for your buck. I mean, it would make an MRI. You might be able to build an MRI in a suitcase. That would be interesting.
Yeah. No, think about it. I think I hear where you're coming from on the antennas. After all, isn't some of the physics of an antenna based on having a radiation resistance equal to the resistance at the feed point or something? And so having an antenna with zero resistance, now that I think about it, might not actually be ideal. Go ahead.
AC2GS. No, in the case of radiation resistance, it's kind of pseudo-resistance. It's not the real ohmic resistance. Real ohmic resistance is the resistance of the flow of electrons through a conductor. And so the loss is turned into kinetic energy, which is turned into heat. In the case of radiation resistance, that you want is just converting the energy into RF and radiating it away. It doesn't produce any heat, any loss, and that's the whole point of the effort. If we could get our antennas to take all the energy that we pump into it and turn it into RF, we have a 100% efficient antenna. So it's not quite the same. Even if you had a superconducting material, you'd still have something we would call radiation resistance.
Okay, yeah, I'm a little out of my depth here, but that's interesting. I know that I think I remember reading in the 70s or 80s at the University of Surrey in England, one of the universities, I think they're on the air as G4ANT, did experiment with a yttrium oxide dipole, but they were not able to commercialize it. I don't know whether it just isn't practical or whether, being a university, they didn't really try. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I can pretty much see two really problematic things. Yttrium is not relatively inexpensive, so your antenna would probably cost a lot more than an aluminum one would. That's the easiest one. Second one is these are ceramic materials. They tend to be brittle. They are not that difficult to break. So unless you really build them bulky, which increases their cost even more, you're going to have them break. So that's another problem. The third really big problem is these are type 2 ceramics, superconductors. You still have to cool them down to around the temperature of liquid nitrogen. So, I remember when I was a kid and holding the rabbit ears for my family to watch television, I would hate to be the guy who had to keep pouring the liquid nitrogen into the trough.
You're kind of noisy. Yeah, I was a little confused there. you said you knew somebody who put TV rabbit ears in liquid nitrogen. I think I misunderstood what you were saying.
Okay. I'm sorry that, once again, the repeater doesn't seem to like this end of Brooklyn. I said that I was, when I was a kid, I was the youngest in the family. I was the one who had to hold the rabbit ears because, you know, they had to be in a weird position. Otherwise, you had double and triple images from multipath. I'm saying that you would have to maintain a temperature of approximately liquid nitrogen, which is expensive and difficult to do. So the material would be expensive, the material would be brittle and most likely break, and if you were lucky that it didn't, you'd probably run out of money supplying all the liquid nitrogen to cool it down.
Oh, all right, I get it. I think I remember doing that, too. Tuning the rabbit ears with body capacitance. as they said on TV in those days, those were the days.
Yes, indeed. I don't know. I mean, I kind of like these days. I think we were born into a great time. I've mentioned this probably too many times. It's kind of the golden age of technology. Every day you wake up and they've invented, discovered, built something new and interesting. You know, when I was a kid, when we were kids, you know, the idea of having a cell phone, an iPad, a flat-screen television set, a computer with the computational power of, you know, 100 times anything IBM could build for you in a mainframe would have seemed like a silly daydream. And yet, here we exist. So I'm enjoying the most out of it.
Yeah, I actually think, and I have to find it sometimes, I understand there are a couple of episodes of the old CBS show, 21st Century, from the 1960s, where they talked about things that technologies that they thought would be developed by the 21st century. And I think somebody took a couple of the episodes, as I understand it, and updated them with 21st century commentary, commenting on what actually happened. I think some of those are on, I've heard some of those are on YouTube, but I have not gone and looked for it. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that would be interesting to watch. I was a big fan of that. I mean, I think that was just a scam. I remember reading someplace about Popular Science when they had nothing better to do. They made lists up. And I used to regularly read the, you know, what the future was going to be like in Popular Science. Unfortunately, I think Elon Musk read the same and just kind of cribbed the notes and kind of pulled it out of his backside as a new invention he had just thought up in his own mind. The trouble is, if you really look through the predictions, they're pretty much all wrong. You'd see a lot of flying cars. You'd see a lot of moving sidewalks. You really wouldn't see what we've done because, unfortunately, we sort of base our aspirations on what came before. And a lot of times new technology just changes the entire picture. So I think people have generally proven terrible at predicting the future. Even very wealthy, very well thought of genius guys like Bill Gates was notoriously wrong about just about every prediction about the internet or computers past the early days when he brought us Microsoft Basic and such. So it's very difficult to predict the future, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, we kind of talked about last week how the idea of wireless communications was actually apparently kicking around starting in about 1869. Apparently a guy by the name of Professor Mallon played with it, and then Edison played with it, and nobody realized its practical value until Marconi. So, you know, it's not entirely technology. Some of it is, you know, some technology, things that are technically possible don't always get developed because the public isn't going to buy them, you know, or people just don't have the imagination to see the, apparently what may have happened in the case of wireless communications, people just didn't have the imagination right away to see its value. Go ahead.
AC2GS. Yeah, we've kind of talked about this before. The best example that I could give you for a technology that on paper doesn't really sound good, but if you have it in your hands, it could change your life, was DVRs. When I first heard about the concept of DVRs, I had probably the same response that 99.9% of the public had, which was, what do I need with this? I already have a VCR that does the same thing. Because the whole idea was it was time-shifting. You could record things, you could play them back later, and all kinds of fun stuff. And it just, I didn't understand what the point was. Like I said, I had a VCR. It was only after I was kind of convinced and I bought it and I used it, and it was a great invention. I love the DVRs in their time. They've become kind of meaningless because of streaming technology now. But sometimes there are concepts that there's no really good way to explain them except to use them. Explanations don't tend to be very useful because we don't really understand. The way we describe things is in comparison to other things. And so if something is different enough than other things, you can't make a really accurate comparison under those circumstances, I found.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. What comes to mind, I remember I bought an Amazon Alexa, one of the early ones. I still have it. It still works well. Not plastic. Still working for now. The big Amazon Alexa still stands in my kitchen bar between the kitchen and dining room, and I still use it. And when I bought it, my wife said, "What good is that thing? What does it do?" Now we both use it constantly. Or maybe I should say use her. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the nature of technology. Rather than when we predict the future, we're predicting what technologically isn't quite ready to exist, and we bring it into existence. The stuff that we have no idea about is the stuff that we're presented with usually, and then you have to rethink everything. You know, I mean, Silicon Valley, whatever, has this thing called disruptive technology, and we've been thrown about by disruptive technology for a better part of a century. I mean, airplanes disrupted technology, microwaves disrupted technology, televisions disrupted technology, and certainly the internet has changed everyone's life, including the guys who hate computers. I mean, they don't kind of embrace it, but it still changed their lives in many ways.
I'm reading the Doris Kearns Goodwin book, Team of Rivals, about Lincoln, and you kind of see the same thing with the development of the ironclads in the Civil War, where the Confederates put copper sheathing on the CSS Virginia, and the Navy men said, "Of what value is that?" And then they found that their current ships couldn't sink her, and they had to build their own ironclad, which they did with an even more disruptive technology, the steam-powered rotating turret. Go ahead.
AC2GS. Yeah, I mean, war has changed wars. If anyone was stupid enough to fight a war the same way that it was fought in World War II, they would lose miserably because technology has changed all of the variables. You can't rely on, you know, I mean, Alexander the Great was a great general, I'm told, a military genius. But, you know, if he applied his technologies there to present-day warfare, he'd lose miserably. So, yeah, that it's a little bit more focused on it's had its greatest effect on warfare itself, but, you know, it bleeds out into outward technology. I was just mentioning earlier today on the 10-meter net that I have that coaxial cables were discovered and built before World War II, but they were incredibly expensive to manufacture. With the amount of coax cables produced during World War II, by increasing the production, they decreased the individual cost. And after World War II, there were a lot of surplus stores full of coax cables, and returning hams grabbed them and haven't looked back. So, yeah, a lot of technology comes out of warfare and changes the whole nature of warfare.
Well, we're kind of seeing it now. The Russians fighting a war using World War II and 70s and 80s Cold War technology versus Ukraine with their drones and more modern Western weapons. So we're actually seeing that playing out now, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, to a degree. I mean, there are some Russian designs that are 21st century, but they're not all ready for prime time, and they're in small supply and get blown up rather quickly and taken off the table. They do have some technologies that they import. They have Iranian drone technology that they seem to be using a lot. So, you know, they're getting, you know, third-party versions of that. But unfortunately, they tend to be kind of using the same handbook that they used the last century. They just brute force it and just throw a lot of bodies at the enemy. And if they're killed, then they send them back in zinc boxes and continue on. So, you know, it probably is time for them to refresh their military tactic book.
Well, hopefully they won't until it's too late. But, yeah, what's going on there is kind of sad. Situation is only getting worse, not better anyway, but the whole disruptive technology thing is interesting, and despite what we think of Elon Musk, it is going to be interesting to see whether Starship turns out to be disruptive technology or just another thing that winds up on the scrap heap of technological also-rans. Go ahead.
Well, supposedly Jeff Bezos is going to go in on it as well. You know, he has his rocket ships too, so he has a means to launch his satellites. I'm very concerned with the amount of satellites that are going to be cropping up in orbit. There's eventually going to be some real terrible billiard board accident where just every one of these damn satellites go ricocheting into each other, and it's going to wreak havoc. And I still haven't really seen the economics of it. I don't think it's viable for a global service. It's very good for wars. Hopefully there won't be that many of those. And it's very good for really out-of-the-way places where you can't get fiber or wire. But I don't think there's enough of them to make an acceptable profit. So I think this is sort of going to repeat what happened with the satellite radios, where there once was two, and then there's kind of one, and, you know, I don't know exactly how well they're doing.
That is interesting. Well, I think they've gone largely to streaming also, as you can get the XM radio app and get it through your smartphone and tablet, etc. You know, any digital connected device. So they're adapting with the times, just like DirecTV also does DirecTV streaming, because of course most of us in HOAs. FCC regs and the Constitution to the contrary can't put up a DirecTV antenna. So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, everyone seems to be betting on streaming services, and there may end up being a time most people can connect to the Internet, so, you know, why exactly you need the satellite to provide you with the link. While the satellites are up there, people have already paid and lost a lot of money on them, so they're practically free except for the maintenance. Eventually, as they kind of fall out of orbit and have to be replaced, it'll be curious to see if they replace them or just shift to some land-based connection.
Well, yeah, fiber optic is supposed to be superior in at least many voice applications, and also in finance because of low latency. And, of course, I'm sure you've seen the flap over the services backed by Wall Street that wants to put up high-speed HF connections, 50 kilohertz wide data connections using 10 or 20 kilowatt point-to-point radios. To facilitate stock trading. I guess they somehow feel they're going to get lower latency from that and be able to beat the market that way. That's the only thing I can figure. Go ahead.
AC2GS. Yeah, I did a story on that during Science Talk about 4 years ago. It's to deal with the latency. Usually they would use the continental internet cables, but those require repeaters, which introduce a degree of latency that the RF signal would improve upon. So it was to cut a couple of milliseconds off of the transmission time to make more of an arbitrage profit.
ARRL is raising hell and saying, well, this is going to be in the edge of the ham band and desense everybody's radio. Well, everybody's radio is being desensed by so much garbage anyway. I don't know for most of us what difference it's going to make. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's not going to improve society. It's just a way for these arbitrage brokers to scrape a couple more $1 billion off the table. So, you know, I'm not a real big fan of arbitrage-based investment people. You know, they don't produce anything. They're kind of outside of the general sensibilities of economic plans. They're just kind of taking advantage of a technical gap.
Yeah, I just find it kind of like what's old is new again, going back to point-to-point HF radio, which is a technology my dad worked with for many years. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, again, that's the beauty of our technological golden age. There are things being invented that let you take another look at something that is old and freshen it up and shine it up real nice and make it capable of doing things that you never thought it could do before. Those are the real clever discoveries where they find interesting new technology that allows you to repurpose old technology.
Yeah, it is interesting from that point of view. I remember when I was a child, my dad taking me for a ride out to the RCA Globecom Riverhead point-to-point HF receiving site where they brought in the MUX and ARQ point-to-point HF signals from overseas to bring them into, you know, the Telex and Twix networks. And, you know, that... I think that site was shut down, just wasn't competitive with satellite networks and the fiber optic networks and shut down quite a few years ago. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's always a moving target, and companies hopefully figure out the gains and losses and move on. They're not stuck in the past. I don't know of any business that's successful that does things because they used to do them. Usually those type of companies go out of business relatively quickly with that type of attitude.
Yeah, RCA had the receiver site at Riverhead and the point-to-point transmitter site at Rocky Point. You know, they were separated, you know, on different forks at the east end of Long Island, I guess, to avoid defensing each other. You know, the receiver site was interesting, diversity reception, et cetera, et cetera. You know, something you can do very inexpensively now with the SDR network. It was a big deal and cost millions of dollars to do in the 60s. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, everything was more difficult, more complicated in the old days. Nowadays, they've shrunk massive machinery down to small integrated circuits that you could buy for a couple of bucks and just, you know, plug it in and have a radio on in a box. Anyway, Frank, it's been great chatting. It's almost 9:30 now. Probably I should kind of switch back to the old mode of asking for questions. But I've enjoyed our conversation tonight.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, for Frank, he's talking about the RCA site out east. Last year, there was a fellow that gave a presentation at the Weimar Club, one of the Weimar Club meetings, and they record all these things. And you can go on to the Limox site, and they have the YouTube. You can click on the YouTube section, and you can find this thing. Whole presentation, all about that. He talked about it. His father worked there, and then he got involved, personally involved, and he had a tremendous amount of stories and details and drawings, and just fantastic. You know, for Frank, anyway. Back to you, Brian.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Paul. So once again, Frank, thanks for participating. As always, always a pleasure.
Yeah, very good. See who else has questions, and then I have a not-too-technical ham radio question, though I don't think any of the on tonight who would know the answer. But go ahead and see who else has questions. WB2BX.
Okay, very good. Once again, this is AC2GS. This is the Limark Technical Net. And I know it's a little bit on the later side, but I thought I'd mix things up and bring my own subjects up front. But now it's time for questions and comments. If you have any questions, hopefully amateur radio related, but we'll discuss anything. So please hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
Question or series of questions.
Okay, anyone else? Okay, Wes, is your question or topic amateur radio related or not?
Yes, it is, but take the other gentleman before me.
Okay. Always a gentleman, Wes. I appreciate that. Ken, what's your question or topic?
Okay. Thank you, everyone. I would like to discuss antenna radials. Lately, I've gotten involved with Parks on the Air, which is basically setting up a station in the park, and part of that station is obviously an antenna. I'm using a vertical antenna with some radials attached. And I'd like to learn more about those radials. I believe there's a formula. I think it's like frequency over 168 is the length or something like that. The things I'm curious about is, what is a good number of radials? How long should they be? And is there a relationship between the number and length of the radials? What is the effect of improper length radials? Will I just have a bad SWR, or will the radiation pattern be affected? And conversely, if I have a low SWR, does that mean I have properly configured my radials, or will I still have a poor radiation pattern? Have I asked enough questions about radials? If you prefer, I can ask them one at a time.
Well, I think you covered the field as far as questions remarkably well. I'll try and address it, and hopefully other people will throw in their two cents. Because, it is a fascinating subject, and I wish there was a specific formula. I've never heard about this formula that you have. I have read a lot of stuff on this. I think I mentioned recently QEX did, I think, a two-issue article on a guy who experimented with different configurations of radials and, reported his results. Let me drop for a sec. Okay. The first thing is, what are radials for primarily? And primarily, they are just another variation on what we otherwise call as a counterpoise. In the case of unbalanced antennas, other than things like dipoles and such, there is a radiating element, and then there is something to take the place of the other radiating element. The theoretical construct is to sort of build a sheet of conductive material like a mirror across the infinities. And so there's a virtual reflection of the actual monopole operating as though it was on the other side. And you can, in real physics, you can shrink that infinitely long sheet of conductive metal to just as little as one wire. So the general counterpoise is a wire countering the monopole of a radiator. You can also arrange them in radials across the base, which is why we call them radial. Let me drop for a sec. So as radials surrounding the base of the monopole, you usually try for an omnidirectional antenna. If you put a counterpoise or one radial, you're going to favor that direction. If you put two, it's going to be a little weird. It'll be kind of a biphasic type of output. If you put at least three, you'll get something close to an omnidirectional antenna. And, of course, you can put four or five or six. There's no such thing as too many radials as far as technology is concerned. It makes things heavy. It makes things expensive. But it's not going to undermine anything. So the question then begins, why are some antennas have three radials and some seem to have 40 or 50? That's where you're putting the antenna. If you're placing a vertical antenna up in the air, all you need are those three or four radials in order to get a good SWR, a good efficiency, and a somewhat omnidirectional radiation pattern. If you plant your vertical antenna on the ground, you're going to couple to the ground, and a lot of the energy is going to be bleeded off. So you might have a decent SWR, but you'll have a terrible efficiency because there'll be a lot of very happy worms that have never felt so warm. That's why a lot of radial designs call for things like 30 or 40 or 50 radials, to add some degree of decoupling to the ground. So hopefully that answers most of the questions. The next one is, how long should you make the radials? And you'll get an argument from a lot of different people for a lot of different reasons. Usually what people tend to end up doing is having roughly a quarter wavelength radials, or sometimes they'll cut them in half and make them eighths of a wavelength. Probably a quarter would be the best, but there's diminishing returns. So the longer is nice if you can handle it, and there are some people who have multi-frequency verticals and then have different size radials for each of the bands that they're designed for. But it's not completely necessary. You can get away with a little something. But the arguments of how many radials you should have, let me drop for a sec. The arguments of how many radials a ground-based vertical should have and what the length of the radials should be is open to contention, and a lot of people argue it, often on 75 meters. So, Ken, did I hopefully answer at least half of your questions?
Yes, you did. Thank you, Roy, and I'll keep on playing. Right now my antenna is up about, I don't know, 1 meter, and I've got four radials approximately 15 feet, and you know, the results are pleasing. So I'll have to experiment some more, but at least I've got something that works fairly well.
Okay, very good. And you have to keep in mind all these measurements are highly dependent upon the wavelength of your transmissions. There's a big difference to the dimensions necessary for, say, a 2-meter vertical versus an 80-meter vertical. Anyone out there who would like to add to what I said or refute what I said or just comment, please feel free. Hit that push to talk. Yes, John.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't hear. Did you confirm KC2SH2?
Yes, I did, John. Please go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, remember, there's a delay, so I may not have heard some of your words. I've been perusing the archives, and what you said is 100% on point, but I think you missed one thing that Dick would have said, and that's that besides the quarter wavelength option, and I haven't heard him talk about the 1 wavelength option, so I'll look into that, but he would have said the 2 options or near infinity, And the good example of this would be on your car, for example. Your mag mount on your car, the car is a near infinity ground plane for, you know, 440, 2 meters, like that. But it is not the perfect quarter wavelength. So, again, the additional option would be near infinity. So as long as you go many wavelengths beyond, or quarter wavelengths, I think, are the two real answers here.
Yeah, well, in the case of mobile mounting, that's a fortuitous situation where you already have the conductor covering your car anyway, so you might as well take advantage of it. I try usually to use best cases of minimum material because we're all trying to keep antennas relatively short, light, and cheap.
Understandable, right, in the real world, yeah, unless you've got something massive. And for example, I've got several mag mounts on the metal roof here. I've got a metal roof, it's a steel roof. Mag mounts stick to it, and it's a wonderful thing. I'm surprised sometimes, 40 miles away, I'm picking up my IRLP node across the valley here. But yeah, real good. I just wanted to throw that in there, that near infinity, quote-unquote, is an option as well.
Well, thanks, John. By the way, earlier you were mentioning All-Star. This repeater is on All-Star. It's node 1901, if that helps you.
Oh, great. That's good news. When I want to get around to building my All-Star node, which I'm kind of half in the middle of, trying to finish it, I'll be confident to know I can still check into the net. That's all. Thank you. AC2, that's connected.
Okay, very good, John. Anyone with any comments before we move on to Wesley?
WS2N. AF2P has a comment.
Okay, you doubled. Paul, go first.
Ready. Out in New Mexico, they showed this massive fire. Plastic facility went up. I wonder if that's... They talked about one of the towns. I missed where it was. I don't know. Alamos. But I wonder if John heard it out there. I wonder if they got it under control. I mean, this is a massive black cloud going up in the air.
Yeah, let me just make sure I had it. Yeah, Paul, there's two fires that have been in the news today. One is that plastics fire. I didn't look exactly where that was. I did see some photos of it, and I heard some news that they were asking Santa Fe residents to stay indoors and not breathe the air. I haven't looked exactly where it is. I have to look that up. The second thing is about 40 miles northwest of here, a forest fire started yesterday, I believe, and we can see the smoke quite dramatically off in the distance. If the wind changes direction, I'm looking out the window now, it's a huge plume going off to the east. If the wind changes direction, if we get any kind of talk about wind and the direction it's coming from. If we get any kind of north or northwesterly winds, we're going to get engulfed in this smoke that's coming from the fire. Apparently, it grew a few hundred acres just in a day, and it hasn't rained extensively anywhere here in weeks or months, maybe, depending exactly where you are.
Okay, thanks for that, John, because the plastic one is the one that made the news. I mean, it was really something. You know, naturally they had the aerial shots, I guess, from a helicopter or something. But I didn't hear about the trees on fire, and that's a problem. Yeah, close the windows. I'm sure you have the air conditioner on. Anyway, back to you, Roy. WS20.
Okay, very good. Ed, you wanted to say something, AF2P.
We have swamp coolers. We'll just draw the air right in from the outside. The fires we had last year was tough because you couldn't run your swamp cooler. You'd just be sucking it right inside. And we had a close fire here last year. It was within the single digits of my home, so 8 or 9 miles away. But fortunately, not a lot of forest between here and there. Anyway, remember, swamp coolers in the Southwest, there's a lot of them. Hard to stay cool when you're sucking in the air from outside. Anyway, AC2, GS from PC2, SHO, back to net control.
They try to sell swamp coolers to everyone, including people who live in humid environments.
It's a foreign thing to people on the East Coast, for sure.
Yep. Well, let me get back to Ed, AF2P. You wanted to say something, Ed?
Thank you, Laura. Yes, this is Ed, AF2P. Chicken wire radios. Huh. I've heard, and I used it for my 160 inverted L, which worked like terrible, but I have a very limited, as many do, lot for putting up a 160. Anyway, chicken wire radios. I've heard of chicken wire spread out with, you know, no size, just as much as you can. It's supposed to work. My antenna works, but very poorly. That's what I have to say. Thanks, Roy. Back to net.
You're welcome, Ed. Well, I mean, I've read up on chicken wire. Chicken wire has a problem. As long as it's not corroded, it's fine. What happens, though, usually with the material that they make is they develop oxidation corrosion, especially where the wires knit together and cross over. And all of those amount to a nonlinear device, which acts as a mixer to the RF that you're generating. So a significant portion of your emitted RF gets kind of mixed together and re-reflected back, and it's kind of rather harmonics-rich. So it's probably not the most efficient radial that you could use. Again, when you first put it up, it might be peachy keen. It's when it starts to corrode around the little contacts that you get all these little mixers mixing. Yep, I mean, there are people who've tried that before, and some of them were happy, and others kind of hunted down what went wrong, and that's usually what they described, what goes wrong thing. You know, again, you could have arguments from today until next year on 75 meters of what's the optimum length. Can they be too long? Can they be too short? Do they have to be 36 if they're on the ground? Can you get away with 20? Do you have to do, is 60 even better? So, you know, there's a lot of points of contention, and people will be tinkering and experimenting and refining for the foreseeable future, because it's not something that's very easy to legitimately, accurately model. So you can't just kind of plug it into any C2 and say, aha, this is the answer. But we'll keep on seeing what people do and reporting the results. Yes. SKI, yes. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, I have a quick question, though. Are there any ESAR computers anywhere in Long Island?
Yes, there are more than a few repeaters on Long Island. Some of them are active. Some of them are not terribly active. The easiest, less useful approach is to go to a website that has repeater lists and type in your zip code and the range of distance, and they'll spit out what's recorded. The problem is a lot of the things listed are not terribly active. When I got into the hobby, I actually wrote up a list for the metropolitan area. I put it on the Kings County Radio Club's website. It was the Hitchhiker's Guide to New York Repeaters, with a list of about 10, 12 repeaters that were used regularly and the types of individuals. You know, some of them were more technical, some of them were more long-winded, some were short-winded, and I even remarked that there was one repeater that sounded like you had landed on a channel on CB. It was just that kind of conversational content. But I don't know of anyone who's done a similar thing for Long Island in general.
That's okay. I'm on the 51A, and I'll just go into a TV, super network of TVs in the area for a digital.
Okay. Well, I mean, ultimately, the best approach is, especially if you have a radio with a PAN adapter, is to just kind of gaze upon the band, see where it's active, and pop over there and take a little listen. Unfortunately, if you do that on UHF, a lot of times, at least I have found, that they're just a bunch of repeaters that are DMR repeaters set to rebroadcast, you know, either worldwide English or American English. You can actually, I can see on my PAN adapter that the peaks and the valleys coincide, so they're transmitting the same audio envelope, which is interesting to see. But, you know, that's probably the best approach in any area, especially nowadays that a lot of radios offer PAN adapters as visual cues to activity on a band. Where is Ham Radio Outlet?
The closest one to New York.
Oh, geez. It sort of depends. I think there's one in Delaware if you're interested in driving south. If you're interested in driving north, I don't remember. I don't think it's Connecticut, maybe Massachusetts or New Hampshire.
WDAV.
Yes, Ed. I'm sure you know this much better than I.
I believe the ham radio outlet north of us is in New Hampshire. The one in Delaware is right at the Delaware side of the Delaware Memorial Bridge. In other words, if you take the Jersey Turnpike to the bridge, it's almost immediately after the bridge main landfill in Delaware.
Okay, very good. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. That's fine. And maybe I can find a cream off or a swap bit out here in New York.
Yeah, New York really doesn't have much in the way. I mean, it has some retail outlets that cater to commercial radio. There used to be a, what is it, KGI or something in New Jersey. I don't know whether his store is back up. It burnt down, and he was selling stock out of his house for a while, and he comes to the Hamfest, but I don't know what the status of his store is. It's kind of very few and far between, unfortunately. There's not high enough a demand for amateur radio equipment that there's more retail outlets than there presently are.
Okay, I got you. Final question. Where is located again?
Where is who located?
Where is he located?
Me? I'm located in lovely Gravesend, Brooklyn, New York, nearby Coney Island.
Okay. Well, this is Alan Moulton here.
That's okay. We all got to be someplace.
Once I get outside the top, I'll just go to GPS and the satellite shows where the digital is going.
Okay. Thank you for participating. I hope you come back. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
Oh, I'll be out there for sure. Thank you very much for your help. Casey, thanks for the help.
You're welcome. Well, now, after much ado, we turn to Wesley. What's your topic for tonight, Wesley?
It's more informational. On 3rd of January 2023, there was a radio very much known in Europe, Radio Luxembourg. They decided to shut down its long-wave broadcast from the gigantic bell-wheeled transmitter in the Luxembourg. So imagine that you have a mass of 250 meters. 250 meters times 3 equals 3 feet in meter. That's the height of each one of the masts. This ends the life of one of the most powerful long-wave broadcast stations in the world, and it was operating for 90 years. Let me jump. Okay. So, Radio Luxembourg operated on the frequency 252 kilohertz, with power 150 kilowatts. It was covering a larger part of Europe. But interesting things happened. There was a guy, Telgen, when radio was just starting, that was 1933. This guy was in Eindhoven, Netherlands, and he was listening to another station that was transmitting at 652 kilohertz. So we say Radio Luxembourg operated at 252 kilohertz. And there was another one in Switzerland, next country, that was operating on 652 kilohertz. And he, in the background of the Swiss station, he could hear the audio of the Radio Luxembourg. This phenomenon was reported by other listeners too. And here we have interesting things. Okay. He started to theorize that the carrier of the Swiss station signal was being modulated in the ionosphere as it passed through the strong signal of the Radio Luxembourg in ionosphere. And I decided to look closer into that. And yes, in radio physics, the Radio-Gorky effect, which was that effect was of ionosphere modulation by radio station. It is called Luxembourg-Gorky effect because there was another radio at this time that was by Comis Russia in Nizhny Novgorod in Russia that was also operating with a very high power, so they could spread the propaganda around the Europe. And they did the same. So those two radios started to interfere between themselves, one of which is strong passing through the same part of medium, especially a conductive region of our atmosphere or plasma. So current theory seems to be that conductivity of ionosphere is affected by presence of strong radio stations waves. The strength of the radio wave returning from the ionosphere to the distance point is depend on the conductivity level. So then I thought about Alaska HARP program with a farm of the antennas and its purpose of it. Decided to check it out. And now this is a subject that might be interested to